This is In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro. Once again this week, police and Occupy protesters met up in various parts of the country. In New York, it was peaceful. In Miami, it allegedly involved assault weapons drawn on peaceful, unarmed residents. And the questions, are you Muslim? Do you love this country? What progress is Occupy making, and how accurate are its depictions by the media? We'll look into it this hour on In Deep. But first, we're going to go into our blogger spotlight for the week. We focus on a story from a blogger that comes to our particular attention. This time, we found it on the Huffington Post. And once we contacted Chris Rotta, we found out that she also blogs in a couple other places. She's one of the featured bloggers at freethoughtblogs.com. And she has a website for her book, liarsforjesus.com. That book is Liars for Jesus, the Religious Rights Alternate Version of American History, Volume 1. And Chris Rotta is Senior Research Director for the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. Chris, that's why it caught my eye, because there is an atheist festival, an atheist rock festival coming up, and it turned into a Christian fighter pilot and Fox News versus the Fort Bragg Atheist Festival. Welcome to the show, and what's the story there?
Well, the Rock Beyond Belief Festival was basically the idea of a soldier at Fort Bragg, Sergeant Justin Griffith, and it was in response to the Billy Graham Association's Rock the Fort festivals, which are these Christian evangelical extravaganzas, these large rock concerts that have been on several military bases. And there were some complaints, protests about the Billy Graham event because it was officially endorsed by Fort Bragg. And the commanding general let the event go forward, but put out a statement that if any other group wanted to have a similar event, they could. And Justin Griffith took him up on it.
Wow. And, you know, I've actually talked to, with your organization, I've talked to Mikey Weinstein a number of times about this heavy, heavy Christian preference in the military. There are tax dollars distributing literature that promote Christianity. This is just the latest manifestation of this. How difficult was it to get this agreement to, was it literally that easy? They said, well, you want to put on your own thing, you can do it. Or was there more to it than that?
There's a lot more to it. It was originally scheduled for last year, but had to be canceled by the organizers because it was supposed to be on the main post parade field, which is where the Billy Graham event was held. And they, at the last minute, almost pulled it to the parade field and were going to move the event to a small theater, saying that, well, there was no guarantee that the numbers of people were going to be there and blah, 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 all the excuses. I mean, the headline speaker is Richard Dawkins. I mean, Richard Dawkins alone draws crowds too big to fit in that theater.
Absolutely.
Right. So, and then, of course, there's all the bands and, you know, it's a, you know, I think it's noon to 8 o'clock, an eight-hour event that they were going to move it. Plus, there's going to be stuff, just like the Billy Graham Rock the Fort event had, there's going to be activities for kids. They're going to have, I believe it's Camp Quest, the secular summer camp, is bringing their stuff, their science stuff for the kids. It's going to be a family-friendly event. The whole bit, I mean, set up basically just the same apples to apples as the religious event, except it's all secular performers and atheist and secularist speakers.
So we have this Christian fighter pilot who gets involved, and that's what he calls himself,
yes.
Jonathan's Doughty. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay.
yeah, he's a member of what's called the Officers Christian Fellowship. This is an organization of 15,000 military officers going all the way up to three-star generals who only 20% of them are retired, which means 80% of them are current officers. And their motto or whatever that they used for the longest time until Mikey Weinstein repeated it so many times on different radio shows and stuff that they changed their motto. But their motto for years and years and years was, their goal was a spiritually transformed military with ambassadors for Christ in uniform empowered by the Holy Spirit.
That'd be great for another country, but not for us.
Right. And that's 15,000. Now, if you think 15,000, 80% of the 15,000, whatever that works out to, around 12,000, 13,000, are in, you know, these are current officers. So, you know, when people say, you know, why are soldiers and, you know, members of the other services, why are they afraid to complain when something happens? Why are they afraid, you know, to lodge official complaints about religious discrimination? It's because, you know, in any given chain of command, they're likely to run into one of these people.
Mm-hmm.
So while the military officially give these statistics of like, oh, we've only had 50 complaints in however many years, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, we've had over 27,000 service members come to us, and veterans also, because there's problems in the VA hospitals too, come to us since 2006.
Well,
there's a little disparity in those numbers.
Yeah,
of how big the problem is.
You know, and the story actually goes on from there, and it wraps up. It ends up with Fox News, and the happy news at the end is that Sergeant Griffith has held his ground, and we're going to point anyone who wants to hear the rest of the story over to your Huffington Post blog entry and your other sites as well. So I really appreciate you bringing this to our attention. It's an exciting story, and I'm
Sergeant Griffith has a blog also on freethoughtblogs.com. If anyone just wants to go follow this there, his blog is called Rock Beyond Belief. And so all updates about the festival and other things that are going on in the military, you can get from his blog.
Fantastic. Chris Rada, thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks.
And Chris Rada's links will be on our website at indeepradio.com. I'm Angie Coiro. This is In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro. Thank you for tuning in again this week. We're going to talk this hour about the Occupy movement, kind of a before, during, and after. And in this case, the past, the present, and future. Occupy has been consistently in the news at fluctuating levels ever since they started making their presence known with one encampment on the East Coast. It gradually spread all throughout the country. The cold weather in some parts of the country started to take a toll. That was predicted. In fact, there were some who said the cold weather would wipe the movement out. Guess again, did not happen. It's still very much active in some areas, although we're starting to see that Occupy is taking on different identities and different tasks as it moves into the future. So let's find out what's happening on the ground with Occupy. Allison Kilkenny is joining us for this segment. She is an In These Times staff writer. You can find that at inthesetimes.com. She co-hosts the radio show Citizen Radio. We'll put a link to that on our blog as well at indeepradio.com. She blogs for In These Times under the Uprising label, and you've also seen her work in some other venues as well. Allison Kilkenny, I could spend the rest of the hour on your resume, but I shan't. Hi, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you earlier today, you were at Zuccotti Park, where last I saw you tweeting, the police were starting to move in, and I thought, boy, I wonder if we'll have a radio guest this afternoon or whether she's going to be warming up a jail cell. So why don't you tell us what the scene was today?
Right. Well, today was sort of one of the big Occupy is back actions. Now that the weather's getting a little better, they decided to bust out one of their more creative plans. And the whole idea was that they planned to go march around the city and take a Bank of America to set up furniture in front of. The whole idea was that they were foreclosing on Bank of America, since Bank of America has been foreclosing on millions of Americans, even though we bailed them out with a taxpayer-funded bailout. So they sort of really impressively and very quickly set up a living room in front of a Bank of America, complete with a bookshelf, furniture, couches, chairs, a rug, a little plant. And it was just a sort of creative protest. And then they marched after that. And when that was happening, there were several arrests. I counted five. I've heard a higher estimate than that, and that's possible. I may have missed a few. Then they marched to Zuccotti Park, which was sort of a homecoming because obviously that is where the Occupy Wall Street camp was. And it was a very exciting moment. Protesters were chanting, spring is coming. They taped off Zuccotti Park with police tape that the police very quickly took down, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I think the last tweet you probably saw was there were about 24 officers that showed up very quickly with the handcuffs off of their waist. And it looked like, they were serious business. We thought they were going to be mass arrests, and then for whatever reason, they just sort of backed off. So right now it looks like, never say never, the protesters may start marching again and there may be more arrests, but at least for right now, it doesn't seem like mass arrests are likely.
Allison mentioned her her Twitter account, by the way. You can follow her at Allison Kilkenny. That's two L's in Allison, two K's and two N's in Kilkenny. When you first started following this up until today, have you sensed a changing in the spirit? And by that, I mean either the intent and attitude of the people on the street or the intent and attitude of the cops who are monitoring this. What kind of change have you seen?
Well, yeah, it definitely seems like the NYPD is aware that they accumulated a vast amount of bad PR during Occupy Wall Street. I mean, the examples of their overzealous behavior are too numerous to name, but obviously the most famous examples being the pepper spraying of protesters at Union Square, the mass arrests at Zuccotti, you know, pretty brutal treatment of protesters at one time square protest, an officer charged a horse into the crowd, like really, really outrageous behavior. And now it seems like they're a little more concerned with, not that they're kind to the protesters by any means, but they seem very aware that they're being filmed all the time by press, and they try to act like they're buddies with the protesters. So for example, today when the protesters didn't seem too sure where they were going to march, one of the NYPD liaisons, everybody refers to him as Hipster Cop. You may have seen his photos online.
Yes.
He approached the protesters, and instead of, you know, treating them in a gruff or rude way, he tends to phrase things like this, where he's like, where can we help you guys go? And stuff like that. You know, like they're trying to be like, we're accommodating you now, which really isn't the case, because anytime the protesters attempt to, like, occupy a park, of course, they're all arrested. But they do seem aware that they've accumulated a lot of bad press during the course of Occupy Wall Street. And the protesters, there's definitely a sense of growing excitement now that spring is approaching. And, I mean, there's May Day graffiti, so just that just means May 1st graffiti, all over the city. Where that's the big date that everybody, you know, is really betting on Occupy coming back in a big way, May 1st. And then obviously the entire summer things are planned. Student strikes, Occupy Chicago still has big plans, even though the G8's been moved to Camp David. NATO's still going to be in Chicago, so there are going to be big protests there. And they're just getting really excited. There was an announcement made today at Zuccotti Park where they're going to have weekly training now for the spring.
Oh.
So just, you know, strategies to protest, whatever their specific plans are, they're going to be meeting and discussing that now.
I want to go back a little bit to the demeanor of the police that you were discussing in New York, and that in part because they've got the high profile now. They know they're being filmed. They know they've had bad press. That doesn't seem to be of concern with the story that you profiled for In These Times in Miami. Absolutely appalling. What went on there?
So there's an interesting aspect to that story. So just to give some background, in Miami, Occupy Miami was evicted from their camp. So they've been staying in an apartment building. And on Tuesday, a SWAT team busted into this apartment building, aimed really, you know, rifles, stuff like that, like very scary weaponry at children, at older people who were there. And they made, they temporarily detained people because they didn't even arrest anybody, because they said there was a report that, you know, they had heard they were stockpiling weapons, which obviously was not the case, but that was their reason they gave for why they broke into this place. Now, what's interesting is the media covered this, but they kept referring to the protesters as occupiers, which I know the journalists meant as shorthand for Occupy Wall Street, but it kind of painted this image of squatters, illegal squatters, and that wasn't the case. One of the occupiers, the Occupy Wall Street protesters, I should say, owns the apartment building. So he was allowing protesters to stay there legally, which means the SWAT team broke in on legal residents and treated them this way. So that, I think that's a really important detail. Obviously, it would be terrible if they did this to squatters, too. That's, you know, completely uncalled for if they're peaceful individuals. But it's even more outrageous that they were staying there legally. They were guests.
You know, what really appalled me the most about this story, I mean, it's bad enough they had the caliber and number of weapons that they had. It's bad enough they show up with this monstrous gray tank of a vehicle an armored vehicle in, you know, in case these peaceful occupiers started throwing lemons. Of course, they were inside an armored vehicle. But
just to clarify, those are two separate things. So in my article, I was writing about the raid, and there also is this tank that Florida police have been using, but those are, as far as I've seen on the reports I've read, they didn't have that tank on that specific raid.
Oh, thank you for the clarification on that. The point I'm working up to, though, is what one of the Occupy people said, that he was asked by the police, are you a Muslim and do you love this country?
Yeah, so this protester is alleging that, so it's very bizarre, right, that, but it, we've seen this time and time again with occupiers, that they're grabbed and released by the police, and they're never charged with anything. They're just arbitrarily detained, never charged, and then released, which is illegal. If you arrest someone or detain them, however briefly, you have to have a reason for having done it. But the police have gotten into this habit of just, because they can get away with it, they grab protesters and then, yeah, sometimes interrogate them without the presence of a lawyer. So this one protester is alleging that he was detained and questioned in this fashion. And, yeah, they were asking him questions like, are you a Muslim? Do you love America? To which he I thought, in a very funny fashion, replied, no, I don't, because of stuff like this, you know, when you are illegally detaining us. It's really it's a worrying trend that we've been seeing where police are detaining occupiers, sometimes arresting them for up to 70, 90 hours, mm-hmm. and then not charging them.
We saw some of that with the Oakland protests. Yeah, out here in Oakland, we definitely saw some of that. We just have a couple.
Yeah, or dismissing the charges, which is still like, you know, obviously it was a ruse to just get them off the streets.
We just got a couple minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about the message of Occupy permeating beyond the protest zone. Since you and I are both busy in the media, we see this information every day, and we follow it probably more closely than does the average person. If we were to stop the average news consumer or average American on the street and ask them about Occupy, do you think Occupy's message is getting through to that person?
No, I don't think so. I think most people think Occupy is done. They're not around anymore. That's at least the impression I get in talking with people, even very progressive, liberal-minded people who I know consume a lot of news and stuff like that. They ask me, like, what's going on with Occupy? Is that even still around anymore? So, you know, the Occupy definitely needs to make a big statement when they come back in the spring, but that's the plan. You know, they're aware that they've sort of dropped off the radar. They're not really worried about that. I mean, Occupy is not running for office. You know, they don't have to worry about being in the news all the time. And, you know, they're aware of the media's fickle, but they're kind of banking on the fact that they'll come back eventually, and they probably will if they keep having dramatic protests like this. But they're more focused on being prepared for the spring, because that's really, they put all of their chips on the spring, you know, and, mm-hmm. and basically they're banking on the fact that people are outside anyway in the spring, because it's nice, it's warm out, and it'll just be easier to get a momentum going again, which is the case, because during the winter it was brutal, you know, I mean, people didn't want to come out to protest, it was freezing.
And nobody would be out there to see them, because it's freezing. Exactly. Allison, I gotta let you go at this point. I thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Allison Kilkenny, you can find her work at inthesetimes.com. She's a Citizen Radio co-host, and she also contributes to The Nation. You can find her blog at allisonkilkenny.com.
Better must come. They can't conquer me. Better must come. curse. Thank God I'm not the worst. Oh, my people get it, see. They try to take advantage of me. Then I must come. Then I must come. Come. Yeah, 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 yeah. Mm-hmm. I've been trying a long, long time, still I can't make it.
I'm Angie Carter. This is In Deep, continuing our hour on the Occupy movement, its future, how it's managed itself so far, and with a particular emphasis on how it's been portrayed in the media. One of the guys keeping close watch on that is Eric Bollert, who works for Media Matters for America. He's senior fellow with the group. And Eric, as you and I were just discussing off air, I caught one of your tweets yesterday that I felt to be consistent with other efforts to discredit the Occupy movement or to paint them in the most ill colors possible. And that is the connecting of a rape near the Occupy site in New Haven. And you were calling the coverage on that. Apparently, the people involved weren't Occupy people. And the first conclusion of the media covering that was, oh, here go those Occupy people again.
Well, yeah, and specifically the right-wing media. This is one of Andrew Breitbart's legacy, is screaming and yelling about how the Occupy movement is full of rapists and things like that. So yesterday, a Breitbart blogger put up this big post about, you know, rape at Occupy Wall Street camp, and he identified there was a mugshot of the arrested person, and he identified him as an Occupy Wall Street member. Well, he wasn't. So, and if you read the local media in New Haven, they reported on how, according to the people who run Occupy Wall Street New Haven, neither the victim, not that it matters, or the perpetrator was a member of the Occupy movement. Both of them were essentially homeless and had been living nearby. But this is much part about, but as you were talking about in terms of how it's perceived, this is part of a much larger right-wing smear campaign to talk, and it's specifically this issue of rape. And you might remember there was a mini controversy. Marcos from Daily Kos and Keith Olbermann had basically debunked a lot of this stuff, because the right-wing sites were talking about all these rapes and all these rapists and they had been taking place at the Occupy Wall Street. And what they pointed out was that in many cases, the victims were members of the movement, but the person doing it had nothing to do with the Occupy Wall Street movement. So they're basically sort of politicizing or attacking these rape victims in a way to politicize it. And that's exactly what they were doing with the unfortunate incident in New Haven, and falsely reporting that the person arrested had anything to do with this movement. So it's just this sort of disgraceful attempt. You know, they can't really argue on the merits. They don't want to stand up for the 1%. Nobody can say, oh, you know, Wall Street's really got our back, and I'm so proud of Goldman Sachs and things like that. So they sort of slide into the second or third mode of just smear campaigns, and it's really disgusting, I think.
Well, can you, in terms of the debunking that took place by Marcos and by Keith Olbermann, have there been, to your knowledge, any rapes at any of the Occupy parks that have been documented, prosecuted? It's something that we can put our finger on and say, this is real, this is tangible.
I think some attacks have definitely taken place. Look, I mean, you're talking about, at some point, hundreds of these encampments all across the country. They're outside. People are living in tents. Unfortunately, there's no question that some unfortunate things have taken place, and there has been crime. There's no question about that. Has it been out of proportion with the rest of the crime and the rest of society? I haven't looked in the statistics. I don't think so. But But what Olbermann and Marcos looked at is, again, is in most of these cases, the victims of these crimes were members of Occupy Wall Street. Why would you ostracize, why would you politicize a crime victim? If someone got mugged at an Occupy Wall Street site, why would you point to that and say that reflects poorly on the Occupy Wall Street people? Why would you insinuate that the victim therefore reflects the community? Nobody should be blaming the victim or things on something like this. I'll give you a perfect example that something that I called out a couple months ago, and this was a Breitbart blogger, and they never corrected themselves and they never apologized. There was an Occupy Wall Street member. I'm going to get the city wrong. It was down south. I want to say North Carolina, but it might have been Tennessee. Was killed. Mm-hmm. This person was killed, and the Breitbart blogger immediately put up a post saying the murder had Savannah. There it is. So the murder had taken place inside the Occupy community in Savannah, and this is disgusting. And these people are mindless, and these people are out of control. And look at progressives today. Well, if you took 3 minutes to look at the local police reports out of Savannah, no, this person was not killed inside the Occupy camp. He was killed all the way across town at 6 o'clock in the morning, and he was murdered in a mugging. So,
but close enough to paint him with the same stripe as far as the right press is concerned.
Just disgusting. So this poor person is killed in the morning on a mugging across town. And these dopes over at the Andrew Breitbart site write it up as if the murder took place inside the camp. And then Media Matters points out there's no connection whatsoever. The police are on record. There's no correction. Oh, well, we didn't really mean to suggest, they just sort of keep digging the hole. We went through this with a week for them, and by the end of the week, they still wouldn't acknowledge the facts of the case. They are so committed to smearing and attacking progressive activists, and again, they refuse to do it on any sort of intellectual basis, arguing about what Occupy Wall Street stands for and the 99 percenters, and they've sort of delved into these very ugly smears and essentially blaming the victims for being robbed or being killed or in Connecticut for being raped. It's beyond the pale.
I'm talking to Eric Bullard of Media Matters. He's senior fellow there, and we're talking about Occupy Wall Street and the other Occupy movements across the country and how they're being depicted in the media. Eric, you ran an interesting column back in October, late October, and you gathered up some of the adjectives and some of the nouns from the right-wing coverage, and you found that Occupy, even while a plurality of Americans were supporting their message and supporting their action, Occupy Wall Street and its protesters were anti-American, anti-Semitic, pot-smoking, communist, Nazis, sexually addicted, whiners, loons, parasites, and petulant little children. And that's just the beginning of the list. My question to you is, how much does that message and that depiction of Occupy bleed into the more mainstream media? In other words, how many people are they fooling?
I think over time it took a toll. I think, if you look at the public opinion polls on the Occupy movement in September, October, and then compared it to November, December, I think it did go down, and I think there were some high-profile incidents around the country that had something to do with that. Initially, the message was very well received, the movement very high ratings, but it did decline, and it's difficult to maintain a movement like that and not to sort of take some shots. But I do think this just, particularly on Fox News, I mean, they were just relentless. They have the biggest platform out of all these people on the far-right conservative media, just relentless. And this has become the hallmark of the conservative media, where it's just nonstop name-calling. I mean, to go off topic slightly on Sandra Fluke, we're now 3 weeks into this story, and the name-calling is just nonstop. And now, they're not just calling her names, they're calling her boyfriend's names and her boyfriend's family's names. This is sort of the level that these people sort of troll around on. And again, with the Occupy Wall Street movement last summer, I think they tried to debate it for about 4 days. And then I think they realized, we don't have anything here. Let's start calling people names.
Mm-hmm. Does it help Media Matters and those who are trying to get out the message about the meanness behind this messaging? Does it help you to let people know that her Facebook has been plowed through, that here are pictures of her boyfriend being depicted? Do you think that resonates with the average person saying, hey, I wouldn't want this to happen to me?
Oh, God. Yeah, that's why the story is still going, because when Rush Limbaugh, you know, went off on this crazy 3-day misogynistic rant, it struck a chord. It didn't have anything to do with Media Matters or liberals being upset. The story has been a story for 2 weeks because people realize, you know, the inherent unfairness in all of it. I mean, this is a law student who testified because she felt passionately about, you know, a public policy issue. What on earth is she now the target of, you know, a slut and prostitute campaign? Which I have to say, if you have to follow the far right media like I do, unfortunately, the venom and the hatred towards her is probably even more pronounced today than it was 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I think we saw that with the Occupy movement as well. It's a very sort of feral, you know, loathing view of the world, and they live in this incredibly tightly sealed echo chamber, and they just sort of whip themselves into a frenzy. Quite simply, it's not even a metaphor or an exaggeration. Between talk radio and the blogosphere and Fox News, and they do really whip themselves into this frenzy, and we saw with the Occupy movement. First, there was sort of early criticism, but by November, December, you know, again, they were racist, they were anti-Semitic, they were rapists, they were killers. You know, it doesn't reflect reality, but yeah, I think, you know, in terms of your question, I think people do sort of take a step back and say, you know, what is this about? Why can't they just argue, have a political debate, and why do they have to sort of resort to this sort of very vicious name-calling?
I don't know if there's a way to quantify this, but is their volume, their coverage, and their influence disproportionate to their number in our society?
Yeah. Well, I mean, just like at Fox News, you know, I think it does have a very large megaphone, but it also has a, you know, essentially has an audience of 2 or 3 million people. You know, this is a country of 300 million people. You know, if you took, 3 million Native Americans and gave them a cable channel, I don't think they would have the same effect that these 3 million people who watch Fox News, because, again, it's an echo chamber, and it's a production, and they feed off the other right-wing media. So, yeah, there's no question that they have a disproportionate voice. The good news is, though, I think they're essentially talking to themselves. I mean, you know, if you turned on Fox News for 10 minutes, you know, you would wonder how Obama hadn't been impeached 5 times by now. And then, you know, you look at the Reuters poll, he's at 50% and he's beating Romney by 12 points. So it very rarely, and if it ever happens, it's by mistake, where they hold up a mirror and it actually reflects, you know, the rest of America.
Well, let's turn the mirror onto ourselves a little bit, or the focus onto ourselves. And by ourselves, I mean the activist left or even the centrist. We used to be called centrist. Now we're fringe left. But how good are we at messaging? And how good is, if we segment off Occupy itself, how good is Occupy at really getting their message out, at getting it to penetrate at even a fraction of how well Fox does it?
Well, I think looking back and having a couple months to separate ourselves from it, you know, I think the Occupy story was an amazing one, because I do think it struck an instant chord, and I do think it tapped into something in a truly grassroots way, in a way the Tea Party never was grassroots, so that was bought and paid for. So I think it did an incredibly successful job in terms of getting this message out there. It completely turned the national debate last fall. It completely turned the mainstream media. It completely turned how we were talking about politics and finances and things like that. So it was a huge success. It was an interesting approach in that, you know, the hundreds of hours that of cable coverage it got over the months, you never saw a single person identified as Occupy Wall Street. They didn't send anyone on TV. They didn't have a spokesperson. They didn't play the normal game. And on one hand, you would think, well, that's a suicide mission. How can you not have a spokesperson? How can you not be fanning your people out onto the cable and Sunday shows if they'll have you?
But as the Tea Party did so well.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it was a conscious choice from the beginning, and it worked, much to my amazement. Now, I do think also, having a couple months to look back, I think that did prove difficult over time, over months and months, to sustain a movement that didn't have a face or didn't have a voice. And, you know, I think that, again, yeah. So I think that was difficult to sustain. But I'm not sure when they started, if they ever thought, okay, we're going to start this Occupy Wall Street, and six months from now we'll be here. I think it was much more of a spontaneous event, and I don't think people were, you know, I think people were hoping for 2 weeks when it started, let alone 4 months. But so I do think it changed. We'd never seen any kind of messaging like this. It proved to be very effective, mostly because I think the message instantly resonated with so many people across the country.
It's interesting we're talking about them all almost entirely in the past tense. Occupy is still out there. What lingering effect are they having, and do you see 6 months from now them still having either a presence or an effect or both?
I think we'll know in the spring. You know, obviously, you know, weather probably had a lot to do with it. It was going to be hard to maintain an outdoor tent-based movement, even though it ended up being one of the warmest winters in history. It was going to be really hard to sustain that over the winter in northern cities and things like that. We were just talking about New Haven. It has happened. But I think we'll see in the spring if organizers are able to recapture, in terms of the numbers and the enthusiasm that they had in the fall, then we'll know whether this is going to continue and go forward. It's tough to, you know, catch that magic again. There's no question about that. But I think, you know, I don't follow this as closely as some other people, but I've certainly seen references to some major springtime events being planned. And we'll, you know, we'll see what the turnout is, and we'll see how they're able to capture people's imagination again.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the unusually warm weather we're having. If Pat Robertson were consistent with, you know, tornadoes blowing away gay people, et cetera, then this would be a gift from God. God must approve
that's
of
right,
Occupy.
That's right. Looking back, they could have tried to, like George Washington, they could have tried to hang on through the winter months. It would have been a lot easier. But who knew that, you know, New York was going to have a winter where basically every day it was 55 degrees.
Let me ask you one quick question. We got about 60 seconds left. You've been following the Rush Limbaugh episode so closely, which I very much appreciate, reading Media Matters writing on that. Where are we standing right now with Rush Limbaugh? Is he still hanging on there with sponsors, or are we having a lasting effect?
No, you know, he's basically, you know, the key sponsors that left early have left. We've seen almost a whole other separate group of 100 corporate America blue chip advertisers saying, you know, we don't buy Rush Limbaugh, but telling their ad agencies, don't you dare put us anywhere near that show. It's interesting, you know, two weeks ago his show was untouchable. Yesterday he was bragging he had 4 new advertisers. You know, he put some, you know, startup show on two stations. So he's clearly taking a hit.
I've got to go, Eric. I really appreciate
your
time. Eric Bullard, Media Matters. I'm Angie Cora. This is In Deep.
Yeah.
This is In Deep. I'm Angie Curro, moving into our last segment, and I'm bringing on, I almost called you a host, Rose Aguilar, because she has guest hosted for me in the past. She regularly chairs Your Call Radio from its flagship station, KALW, in San Francisco. And Rose, you've given some of the most consistent and in-depth reporting to what's been happening on the Occupy front locally, and for us that includes Oakland, which has made headlines across the country as well. And you've paid attention to it as a nationwide phenomenon in the media, in the both traditional and non-traditional media. So I'm really glad you could spend some time with us. Thanks for coming along.
Well, thank you, and thank you for continuing to cover Occupy.
Well, that's just it. You know what? You and I were chatting a little bit, and we talked about how, for some people, it has fallen off the radar. A little earlier this hour, I talked to Allison Kilkenny, and she said, frankly, no, the average person on the street, if they're paying attention at all, probably thinks that Occupy is over. Eric Bollert talked about it almost entirely in the past tense, and it is in a period of kind of stasis, but it's not dead. It's still happening.
No, it's not dead at all. And I just spent a couple hours doing research for your show. And the trend that I'm seeing is that the national media will focus on a big action, say, in New York, but they're not doing a good job of taking a look across the country to find out what's happening. On Thursday, you had hundreds of activists in St. Louis talk about their future strategies. Protests took place at Bank of America and Monsanto, which is based in St. Louis. Also on Thursday, there was a flash mob in Detroit in front of the Westin Book Cadillac Hotel. They're protesting business leaders gathered for a CEO summit. On Wednesday, the Wall Street Journal did cover this because it happened in Manhattan, but Occupy demonstrators targeted a Mitt Romney fundraiser at the Waldorf Astoria.
Brilliant.
And you had about 200, and it was a great action because they dressed up in suits and nice gowns. About 200 people gathered for the 1% for Romney rally. And those things are very effective because they confuse people. You know, that they say, I want to keep, you know, give me more tax cuts. I'm a proud 1%er. And people walk by saying, what is this about? And then they eventually get it. And then Tuesday, now I did not see this reported at all, but it was a national day of action against Chase Bank. And there were protests across the country. Occupy Seattle had actions. 14 people were arrested in Atlanta. They had actions at 5 different Chase banks in the area. So there is so much going on. Activists in New Haven, Connecticut are still camping out. They've been there for 5 months. I didn't even know they were still camping out.
And you know what's notable months. About that? That's what we were discussing with Eric Bollert, because that started to get more attention in the media because of an alleged rape that happened. And it was first portrayed by the right-wing media as, there go those Occupy activist rapists again. It turns out neither the victim nor the alleged perpetrator had anything to do with Occupy.
Exactly. And a judge just ruled that the campers can stay for another 2 weeks. And then I love the small town actions, because even at the height of Occupy, you had Oakland and you had New York, and of course they deserved attention. But what really fell through the cracks were places like Little Rock, Alabama. They have been occupying a parking lot outside of their main post office for 5 months.
Wow.
Yes, and before that, the Clinton Center for a month. So this is a total of 6 months. Where are we reading about this? And they might be forced to move, but they said, fine, move us, but our message remains the same, social and economic justice for all. So Occupy Petaluma, Occupy Monterey, Occupy Santa Rosa. I mean, there's so much going on across the country that we're not hearing about. And these groups, if they're not camping, they usually meet on the weekends, and the main focus right now, based on what I've seen, is mainly foreclosures, because so many people are losing their homes.
Yeah, in fact, I'm hearing that in a lot of Occupy camps, you find the people who traditionally would not be part of an activist movement, and they're there because they're either foreclosed on or they know someone who's been foreclosed on. And that, even early on in the game, that's some of the early coverage we were seeing. I remember that iconic picture of a grandmother covered in goo that she had had to be, I guess she was sprayed down with milk to counteract the gas. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, she was pepper sprayed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm glad you brought this up about the different people that show up, because you tend to see the stereotypical people in the media. But when I went down to Occupy Monterey a couple of months ago, I said, you know, I'm a reporter from San Francisco. I'd love to meet those of you who are just getting involved for the very first time. And I had 5 people line up. And they all, of course, were amazing. But the one person that stands out for me is Karen Ford. She's a lifelong Republican. It was her first Occupy event ever, and she said she's so tired of where the Republican Party is going that she decided to join the movement. And she's a lawyer who used to represent big corporations, and now she represents people who are suing their employers.
Wow.
And her story is amazing, but you're not hearing voices like that.
There are a couple different directions I want to go with this. First of all, let me let our listeners know, you're listening to Rose Aguilar, and in addition to her radio hosting duties on KALW San Francisco and her show that is distributed from there, Your Call, she's also the author of Red Highways, A Liberal's Journey into the Heartland. You can find my original interview with Rose about that book when it first came out at our website at indeepradio.com. But Rose, I especially think of your work, Red Highways, when you took off just to basically take the temperature of people around the country to hear about the quote-unquote flyover areas, meeting people face-to-face. And now, of course, we're hearing that in Alabama, there's an Occupy movement.
Right.
Is that a change for the area? Are these people you were able to find the first time? Do you think something has really become different in people's minds there?
Well, I took this road trip. I believe it's been so long, in 2005, and a lot of people were so disenchanted with the system, especially people living in poverty and the working poor. They know what's going on because they're affected by the policies first. They're making minimum wage. Their brother is in Afghanistan. Their niece is in Iraq. So they know exactly what's going on, but they weren't really involved because they're struggling to get by and they feel like their voice doesn't count. But I think what's happened here is that Occupy has changed the conversation so drastically that people actually feel like once they come together, and in a place like Little Rock, occupying a parking lot for 6 months, and I don't know how many there are there, but enough to make them feel like their voices actually matter, mm-hmm. That's the big difference. Because when I was on the road, you've got half the country, they don't vote, they don't take part because they feel like nobody's listening to them. And now they feel like their voices matter for the first time. And that's powerful. And that's, again, something the media have completely missed. I mean, I should say national media, the sort of soundbite media, they've missed that. And that's it's a really powerful change that we're seeing.
Well, that's, in fact, another thing I wanted to ask you about, because you mentioned that in some cases it's the small town news or the hometown news, the, you know, review of the headlines at 5 that's doing the coverage here. What's the gist of that coverage? Is it they took up the sidewalk and 20 people were there, or are they focusing on the message? Are they actually trying to ask these people why they're out there?
Well, that's what makes it so exciting. They're actually asking people why they're out there. Mm. They're interviewing people. Who are you? Why are you here? They're given more than 30 seconds to speak. I get some of my best coverage by looking in the small town papers. In fact, right now, people listening, go to Google News and just type in Occupy, and you'll find things happening across the country. And I love watching the TV segments because they've got a reporter on the scene, and they're actually giving people a voice.
You're listening to Rose Aguilar as we spend our last segment talking about the Occupy movement. And if you've missed any portion of this broadcast, you can find it at our website, indeepradio.com. Rose, you actually went up to UC Davis and did a follow-up on one of the most noticeable, one of the biggest headlines that Occupy got up front once it moved out to the West Coast. And that was where the students were protesting at UC Davis, and they were pepper sprayed so deliberately. It was just such a cold, calculated act. And that video just lit up the internet and TV screens across the country and even across the world. So Right. Where are these people now?
Well, we move so quickly with our media cycle. And I often think about what happened with the young woman in Portland, that there was that amazing photo of the pepper spray going right into her mouth. And so I've been thinking, what are these students dealing with? What was it like for them when they went home for the holidays? How has it changed their lives? Because you're talking about 18-year-olds who were brutally pepper sprayed. So I spent the day at Davis. And what is so incredible is some of these students have never been political before. And they were pepper sprayed. I met this one young man, Ian Lee, and he's from Los Angeles, 18. He'd been on campus for 6 weeks, and lo and behold, he joins this action at the very last minute, and he gets pepper sprayed. He said it burned for 3 straight days. He was in so much pain. Pretty shy guy. But I said, so what did this do to you? And he said, well, before this happened, I believed that the school and the state really cared about my well-being, and now I don't think they care about us at all. And as an 18-year-old, to have that realization, that's pretty intense. I mean, what do you do with that? And the other students I interviewed said that it's completely radicalized them. And what they mean by that is that they're really delving into how the system works, the entire conversation on that campus has shifted. So they're talking about inequality. They're talking about the system. They're talking about the gaps between the rich and the poor. And it's completely energized. Just so many students that really were not involved before. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing to speak with these 18, 19-year-olds who said, you know, I lost my friends over this. It really hurt. But I am so dedicated to this cause now. And there's actually a bank on their campus called U.S. Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And I checked in with them a couple weeks ago. They have shut down that bank every single day for the past few weeks because U.S. Bank gives out loans to the students at very high interest rates.
Oh.
And they say, we don't want you on our campus because you're taking advantage of us. And they have a food pantry on campus. It's so bad that a lot of students don't have enough money to eat. So they have to go to the food pantry on campus.
God, that's appalling.
I know. And it's such an untold story. I have to say, I haven't written about it yet, but I have all of these great comments from these students because, as you can imagine, this incident has completely changed their lives and the way they see themselves and the role they play in this conversation. I mean, it was really exciting to see this.
You know, one thing I've been wondering about the effect of the Occupy movement and the way that its message is to some extent getting out into larger society. I was looking at the coverage of the man who quit Goldman Sachs so publicly with the editorial in New York Times, Greg Smith. And of course, the media has caught on to all the parodies it's doing. You know, Darth Vader quits his job and leaves. But
right.
More seriously, when I was looking at the coverage in Forbes, there's a paragraph that stood out to me, and I found myself wondering, now that people are aware of Occupy, now that they're looking at the world perhaps a little bit differently, I wonder if they'll hear this paragraph differently. Here's the paragraph. If what Smith is saying today is true, the biggest problem remains the Muppets, not Kermit or Gonzo, but the investors that Smith claims continue to buy garbage from Goldman. Until those clients start to take responsibility for themselves, Goldman will remain incentivized to sell stuff to them.
Hmm.
And I find myself wondering how many people would have read that and said, huh, interesting before, or maybe even not interesting, and they read it now and say, wait a minute, who's the victim here? Who's doing
right, exactly.
The selling? Who's benefiting?
It's so true. I mean, when I heard about this story, I thought about Bernie Madoff and all of the people that were taken for a ride with his Ponzi scheme. But you know, it's amazing. I keep hearing these journalists say, so is this really the entire culture on Wall Street? And I used to work in the dot-com boom, and the same thing happened back then. I mean, they were propping up these companies that they knew were never going to be profitable, and they lied. And even behind closed doors, they were calling them crap. They knew they were going to falter, but at that time, they were making so much money on them by propping them up. So this is nothing new. And I find it laughable that you have these national, very influential reporters saying, well, is this really what's going on, or are these a few bad apples? I mean, this is the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, are we going to see an investor revolt? Because we're talking about people with a lot of money, and they are playing with fire with that money. So I'm just waiting to see what happens next with this story.
Well, what about what happens next with Occupy? One of the early depictions of Occupy, and I'll ask you about the accuracy of that, was that they were a multi-headed monster. They really didn't have any organization. If you ask them what they were out there for, I saw this depicted so many times. You ask them what they're out there for, you get 12 different answers from 12 different people. And early on, that was used to be very dismissive about them.
Oh, yeah, and it still is. I mean, I have friends who say, I don't know what the message is. Well, for example, 2 Mondays ago, you had 5 to 10,000 students go to Sacramento and California to demand an end to budget cuts. Well, they had a clear list of demands. They want the millionaire's tax. They want more of a say. They want an end to all of these loans that they're taking out. I mean, it was a very clear list of demands. So, yes, of course, there's so much on the table, but that's because the system is so broken. Mm-hmm. And you've got teachers who want their say, and you've got healthcare workers who want their say. Name it. And at the end of the day, the main message is that the system is broken. I mean, you've got this 2012 election coming up. It's expected to cost $8 billion.
Good God.
So I think that at the end of the day is the main message. And I know that a lot of occupiers, they want nothing to do with the political process. A lot of them don't vote. They don't want to talk about candidates. But at least in our state of California, the students are saying, we need you to go to the polls to at least vote for this millionaire's tax. Because if it doesn't pass, we're going to see another $5 or $6 billion cut from higher education. And these students can't afford that. Because as it is, they're having to drop out because they can't afford tuition.
Do you think at some point the right-wing mainstream or right-wing media is going to be forced to acknowledge that this is a legitimate movement and not a bunch of crazies? Or are we just going to see that same drum being banged the whole time?
I don't think the right will ever say that this is a legitimate movement, because that's not what they're about. I think they'll keep stereotyping it and broad brushing it. But people are waking up saying, wait a minute, who are the Chamber of Commerce? Why do they have so much influence? Who are these Koch brothers? How much money? Do we really want Sheldon Adelson giving $10 million to Gingrich? And he said that if Romney is the candidate, they could, you know, give $100 million. I mean, people are really fed up. I'm meeting people who were not active before. And they're actually getting active because they're so fed up with this process. And it's not just the Republicans. I mean, President Obama is traveling around the country raising, you know, going to these events, charging $38,000 per plate. Mm-hmm. And he's going to take part in all of this super PAC money raising. And we've got these shadow super PACs that can raise unlimited funds with no transparency. People are fed up with this. I mean, you've got, 7 million women in this country who live off less than $6,000 a year?
Yes.
I mean,
this is
unbelievable.
And the issue is to get them all out there to vote, because I know that the unmarried women are the most likely not to go to the polls.
Exactly. And to get them out onto the streets, because we know what happens when you vote and then go home.
Yes.
you've got to stay out on the streets and make your voice heard. And, you know, what the changes that we are seeing on a daily basis is people are keeping their homes. And that is huge. They are pressuring the banks to take a look at their mortgages and, you know, talk to these people at the table and say, okay, well, maybe we really should work with you on your mortgage. Before this, forget it. They would kick these people out of their homes.
Yes.
So they're really making an impact, even at the grassroots level.
You know, as always, you're such an amazing guest, Rose. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Andy.
Best.
So great to talk to you. And I'm so glad you're covering this. It's great that we have voices like you on the radio. It's so needed.
Rose Aguilar hosts Your Call Radio from his flagship station, KALW, in San Francisco. I do encourage you to look up her book as well, and you can find that at independent bookstores and on Amazon, Red Highways, A Liberal's Journey into the Heartland. And that's a wrap on this hour of In Deep. Stick around. We've got more to tell you all about. In fact, we're going to spend the entire next hour with Tracy McMillan. Tracy McMillan is the author of The American Way of Eating. And she'll let us know what it's like to joust publicly with Rush Limbaugh. Follow us on Twitter at In Deep Radio and on Facebook, In Deep with Angie Curro. You can always send your questions, comments, and guest suggestions to feedback@indeepradio.com. We'll be right back with more of In Deep. Thanks for tuning in this week to In Deep, which is a production of Live from the Left Coast. You can get more information on the show and our company at lftlc.com, Live from the Left Coast. While you're there, you can become a member and support our work. We have a separate website for the show that is indeep.org. If you have any questions or feedback, there's a contact button right there, indeep.org. We are developing a recurring series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy, and you're a big part of that. We'd like your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions. Send them in via our website, the contact button at indeep.org. Join us again this time next week for two more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Curro. Thanks, and we will see you then. You're listening to WPWC, 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.